Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Science of 2016 edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week we discuss the top science news stories and discoveries of 2016. Let's begin episode 362.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your political scientist and skeptical philosopher. This is a two-part year in review. The first installment on this week's show will have the focus on science. The second installment next week will deal with news and politics. One never knows when compiling a list like this whether to start with the smallest story of the year and build up, or hook people with the big story and then present them randomly. I think I'm going to go with the hook and random method. The biggest story of 2016, in my estimation, was the discovery of gravitational waves, of which you should not be confused with gravity waves. Gravitational waves are, in their most basic sense, ripples in space-time. Einstein's theory of general relativity predicted them over a century ago. They are generated by the acceleration, or indeed deceleration, of massive objects in the cosmos. If a star explodes as a supernova, gravitational waves carry energy away from the detonation at the speed of light. If two black holes collide, they will cause these ripples in space-time to propagate, like ripples across the surface of a pond. Remember, space-time, as Einstein envisioned it, and well, scientific evidence has since shown, is essentially the fabric of the universe. But unlike the fabric of your trampoline, to keep stride with the standard analogy, this kind of fabric includes forces. Most notably in this case, gravity. That means that the very fabric of space and time can be stretched or compressed by gravity. This means that if a significantly large enough gravitational event were to occur, the fabric of the universe would not only shudder, but time and distance will change, or ripple, if you will. Gravity waves, on the other hand, are physical perturbations or variations driven by the restoring force of gravity in a planetary environment. In other words, are specific to planetary atmospheres and bodies of water. So, for example, you drop a rock into a pond. You create ripples. Those ripples are being pulled down by gravity, but also being pushed up by buoyancy and the kinetic energy of the rock. But, of course, the pull of gravity is constant, while the energy of the rock is finite, relatively speaking. So the pond is eventually smoothed out by gravity. Or put another way, gravity waves pull on objects in space-time, while gravitational waves pull on space-time itself. That is, gravitational waves in the fabric of space, their changes to space-time, vis-a-vis Einstein's theory of relativity, while gravity waves are changes caused by gravity on material, but in no way is changing space-time. Anyway, in February of last year, scientists published a paper where they reported that they saw gravitational waves created when two black holes collided and formed a new singular black hole. The device they used to measure these waves in the gravitational field were precise. How precise? It's using a measurement to a distance of 10 to the power of negative 19, or 10 zeptometers, or another way to think about it, a proton, that positive bit at the center of atoms, is 10,000 times bigger. It would be like trying to read a license plate on the planet orbiting Proxima Centauri. How do you make such a precise observation? Well, the observatory is L-shaped, with each arm being about 4 kilometers long, and at the heart is a laser interferometer. What's a laser interferometer? Well, at the point where both lanes of the L meet, there is a laser that blasts out a beam of photons. In front of that laser is a beam splitter. So some of the photons keep going straight, while others are deflected 90 degrees and head in the other lane. At the end of each lane is a mirror that reflects the beam back to the central point. It bounces down its lane about 280 times, giving the observatory an effective length of over 1,000 kilometers. At this point, a switch is flipped, and instead of being bounced back to the center point, it is directed towards another beam splitter, or more accurately, now a beam combiner, and then off to a collector. Now ideally, if there's no interference, these two beams of photons should combine as if they were never split. But, and herein lies the observatory, by that I mean a completely new way of seeing the universe, see it not in visible light, radio waves, the common electromagnetic waves we are currently limited to, but this adds a completely new sense of seeing to the universe. And by sense, I mean it's as if a blind person could suddenly see. We are getting our first new peek in the vision of gravity, and its promise is immense. If a gravitational wave happens to pass through the Earth, well, it would, as all waves do, have a direction. That means as it passes through the observatory, one lane will be shrunk a little and the other stretched a little. Thus, literally the distance traveled by each beam is different. Thus, when the beam is recombined, the photons form an interference pattern. Of course, there are other things that can cause interference, not just the bending of space-time. The sun, cars, earthquakes. To filter out nuisance noise, when photons are received at the collector, they form interference patterns. In this case, very complex patterns. These patterns are red. Known sources of interference, like the sun, moon, trucks driving, are removed. And with luck, a gravitational wave is seen. Now one might say something like the sun or the moon are predictable enough to rule out. But how do you account for cars or the like? Well, LIGOS, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Observatory, of which we've been discussing, is not a single observatory, but a pair of observatories. One set up in the state of Louisiana, and the other in Washington State. Thus, local interference can be filtered out, and it is only when both observatories observe the same thing that a candidate observation is made. There was a lot of double-checking made necessary, especially because of a mistake made before by another research team 2 years ago, when gravitational waves were thought to have been seen, but later evidence / analysis proved this a false claim. So this time around, everyone was double diligent. And as I mentioned, a second signal has been observed, thus in an odd way, providing reproducibility. Now one of the reasons this made it to the top of my list is just not again confirming Einstein's theory of space-time relativity, but this was the first direct observation of a black hole. In fact, I have learned something about black holes I was not aware of before my research for the show. Now I mentioned that this gravitational wave was generated when two black holes collided, but did you know that one star created both black holes? Stop, I'm with you. I also said, feck that, that's impossible. We all know black holes are formed when a single star blows up in a supernova, leaving behind a singular black hole, or maybe a neutron star. But singular, one boom, one hole. Well, as it turns out, it is indeed possible, but only under very special conditions. First, there needs to be a star of sufficient mass as to, if you could sort of cut it in half, each half would be massive enough to create a black hole. Then this star must be spinning at extreme speeds so that its mass spreads out and forms a barbell shape. Then, as things progress, each bell would experience its supernova event and thus create two black holes at each end of the bar. In fact, it was this initial condition, two black holes created in proximity to each other and orbiting each other, that made the inevitable crash into one another, well, inevitable, which allowed us to realize we can now see the universe in a new way. What do I mean by that last part? Well, as I hinted at before, we are seeing in an entirely new way. For the entire history of humanity, we have been limited to observing the universe with only one of our senses, visual. Until recently, it wasn't possible to touch objects in space. And even today, our reach is extremely limited. Because there's no air in space, we cannot hear what other worlds sound like. The only way we could explore the universe is via vision. And for most of humanity's stint on this planet, that vision was limited to the visible spectrum. In recent days, we have expanded that to radio waves, infrared. We are now able to see the universe in the complete electromagnetic spectrum. But fundamentally, this is only one way of seeing the universe. Now, all that has changed. We can now see, or maybe better put, feel the universe in gravitational waves. And who knows what, quote, spectrum that may lead to. But it's early days. And yet, on a very fundamental level, our ability to understand the universe expand exponentially. What that may mean for the future, we'll have to wait and see. Let me tell you about one of the bigger stories of 2016 that will, in all probability, likely lead to a similarly big story in 2017. But let me start at the beginning. As you may know, there are beyond the orbit of Neptune, the Kuiper Belt, a collection of dwarf planets, asteroids, comets, and various stellar debris, often referred to as trans-Neptunian objects. And no, these are not objects that dress up as Neptune in their private time. It simply means they are beyond the orbit of Neptune. This is where you find the former planet, now diminutive dwarf planet, Pluto, as well as a few other lesser, or depending on your geekiness, better known dwarf planets such as Sedna, Charon, Eris, Huma, and Makemake. About as far back as 2004, people began noticing an aberration in the orbit of the trans-Neptunian objects, that a number of them seemed to have an eccentric orbit. Not only eccentric, but similarly eccentric. By 2014, there were papers published pointing to a possible gravitational source to these eccentric but relatively consistent, what I would call out as normal orbits. What do I mean, out of the norm? Well, most objects in our solar system revolve around the common plane, which, put another way, most objects in the solar system orbit around the sun's equator, within a degree or 10. The Earth itself is an oddball with an orbit about 7 degrees off the sun's equator, with most of the other rocky planets being about 3 to 4 degrees off, and the gas giants about 6 degrees off. And on a side note, that's kind of a mystery in itself as to why the planets don't actually orbit around the sun's equator, but more on that later. Well, these objects of note, Sedina, 2012 BP113, 2007 TG421, 2004 VN112, 2013 RF98, 2010 GB. Yes, these are not the most sexiest of names, but science is about knowledge, not about sex. Unless you're a sexologist, but I digress. These objects, and the current study group is now 10 trans-Neptunian bodies, well, they all seem to share a common malformed orbit. By malformed, I mean compared to the wildness of Earth's orbital inclination, the degree of the stellar plane, or equator, which was 7 degrees, these objects clock in at anywhere from 12 to 30 degrees off-center, if you will. And not only were there a number of objects, sizable objects on weird orbits, but there are a number of them that could be grouped together, meaning that their orbits are not random, but likely were all influenced, if to different degrees, by a common attractor, which could account for all of their off-centered orbits. Well, last year, a paper was published that could explain all this weirdness. It was proposed that a ninth planet was lurking in the Kuiper Belt, and not only some namby-pamby planet, but a super-Earth. The simulations pointed to a planet about 10 times the mass of Earth, about 3 times the diameter, orbiting anywhere from 200 to 1200 AU from the Sun. The measure AU, or astronomical units, is simply the Earth-centric measure of the distance from the Earth to the Sun. The cause for the large variation, i.e. 200 to 1200, is that it is believed that this planet will have a very eccentric orbit. That is, its orbit is not a circle, but an ellipse. Think of the difference between a ball and a stretched elastic band between two fingers. Thank you, Kepler, for doing all the math that makes this equivalent for us. How could such a single object have such a varied orbit and still produce such common effects in the trans-Neptunian objects? Well, it really comes down to being in the right place at the right time. Their simulation, and they ran quite a number of them, showed that when such an object like Planet 9 was located at X, Y, or Z, it could have such an effect. That said, it was not clear as to where this planet would be during the rest of its orbit. Well, not quite. And this is why I think this year we will have visual confirmation of Planet 9. So they are unsure of the exact orbit of Planet 9, other than it had to be, or had to exert, a gravitational pull at particular points in the solar system. That limits the number of possible places it could be right now. And as telescopes and astronomers scan each possible orbit, we are likely to see Planet 9 this year, fingers crossed. Oh yes, and not only has this discovery, or conjecture, let us use the correct terminology, this conjecture also explains another weirdness of our solar system. Remember back, I mentioned that most of the planets of the solar system orbit about 4 to 7 degrees off the sun of the equator. You might have thought that the offset was a function of the planets. But as it turns out, no, the planets are more or less orbiting in the stellar plane of rotation. It's the sun that's actually off kilter. This has been a problem. Astronomers and like have come up with some imaginative and elaborate explanations as to why the sun is tilted relative to the rest of the solar system. Well, it seems that if Planet 9 does exist, its eccentric pull on the sun could account for this wobbliness. Why is this so cool? On the top of my lists? Why is it fantastic? Well, it is likely the last time in my lifetime for sure, but likely humanity's existence, that a new planet, a real full-fledged planet, will be discovered in our solar system. We all mourned the demotion of Pluto in 2006, but it seems the gods will not be denied. A solar system with 9 planets will be true, no matter how obscure and distant that final body may be. And this is one of those times that we can see science at work. We have a set of data, the orbits of some of the trans-Neptunian objects. We notice a pattern in the data. A number of them are offset from a stellar plane by a noticeable and common amount. We draw a conclusion. Some gravitational body, i.e. Planet 9, is affecting these objects, supplementing and providing a secondary line of evidence. We can account for the inclination of the sun, if such a gravitational body exists. Based on those conclusions, we make a prediction that such a planet should be visible in a relatively limited amount of space. Once these predictions are shown to be true, we have a new fact in the universe. Our solar system has 9 planets. Currently, we're at the final step. I think we will find Planet 9. But if we don't, well, maybe the math was wrong, or our mysterious planetary companion lies elsewhere in our solar system. Or we are back at the drawing board and finding some explanation for the observation. Science is so cool. We'll be right back after this break.
Your cell phone already has an FM receiver chip installed in it, but major Canadian telecommunication and mobile companies have blocked access to this free system to listen to the radio in favor of charging for data streaming. With access to the FM chip, your phone can still receive broadcasts and updates during an emergency, even if the cell towers are down. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 CITR FM, your nuclear-powered, diamond-encrusted radio skeptical broadcast. And we're back. Here's one of the coolest stories of 2016. Let me just give you the title. Diamond Nuclear Feckin' Batteries. Yes, that now is a thing. Okay, what are these gem-quality power plants? Well, first, let us talk about a major problem with nuclear power. And I should preface this with the acknowledgement that I am a fan of nuclear power. I think it is a great stopgap between carbon fuel and green energy. I also think that with improvements in technology and safety, nuclear power is the best source until fusion power becomes mainstream. Okay, so one major part of a nuclear power plant is its graphite control rods. These are rods that help absorb neutrons and control the speed or the power of the nuclear fission reaction at the heart of every nuclear power plant. One part of the waste of the nuclear power plants are these graphite rods. which, at the end of their lifetime of absorbing those neutrons and just being in the presence of all that radiation, suffice it to say, at the end of their working life, they're highly radioactive. Research, though, has shown that it seems that only a relatively thin layer of the graphite on these rods is where the most dangerous radiation can be found. The type of carbon formed is carbon-14, which has a half-life of about 6,000 years, as opposed to the carbon that makes up most of you and me, carbon-13. And for those of you who may be thinking that we all have carbon-14 in us, that's how radiocarbon dating works. That's true, but the amount generated in the environment and which gets incorporated into organic life is a trace amount, about one part in a trillion, enough for carbon dating, but not nearly enough to be a risk to you or me. And for those wondering, this radioactive carbon-14 is created in the upper atmosphere when nitrogen-14 is hit by a cosmic ray and evolves into carbon-14. The highest rate of carbon-14 production takes place at an altitude of anywhere from 9 to 15 kilometers, and the amount of carbon-14 will vary depending on the solar wind and the sun's magnetic field, where most of the cosmic rays necessary are generated. Side note, it seems that scientists noted a carbon-14 spike in 774 CE, where a very strong solar flare, perhaps the strongest ever known, created an abundance, relatively speaking, of carbon-14. That said, what is significant in a scientific sense is not always considered to be that much in a layman's terms. The dramatic increase was only 1.2%. So we're still only talking about 1% of all carbon is carbon-14, at least in the wild. That said, in the graphite tubes, the amounts are closer to 10%, or put another way, 100 billion times more concentrated, abundant, whatever, than in nature. The research published last year found that the majority of the radioactive carbon-14 is concentrated in a thin outer layer of these graphite tubes, and that this layer can be removed by vaporizing the carbon. This vaporized carbon can then be used to create essentially radioactive diamonds. Carbon, by any other name, is a whole lot of different stuff. Sorry, Shakespeare. And what do I mean by that? Well, graphite, charcoal, soot, graphene, diamond, are all just pure carbon atoms grouped in different ways, different structures. I.e., in graphene, the atoms of carbon are arranged in a single layer shaped like a honeycomb. In diamond, they form a three-dimensional arrangement of carbon shaped like a cube. Well, coal is more random. So a diamond is a cube, irrespective of the kind of carbon, a property of diamond, vis-a-vis their crystalline structure, that, in the presence of a radioactive field, they can generate an electric current. As we mentioned, and as seems obvious, because the carbon used to make the diamond is itself radioactive, well, it provides its own power source. The carbon-14 that makes up the diamond is radioactive, and when placed in a crystalline structure, like the diamond, well, it spontaneously generates an electric field, a field that can be tapped into and used as a power source. Why? Well, as stated, the structure of diamond means that when irradiated, they generate an electric field. Normally, that irradiation comes from an external source, like putting a diamond in a nuclear reactor. But of course, the carbon we are using is already being in a nuclear reactor, so it's giving off beta particles that generate the electric field. Thus, these diamond nuclear batteries power themselves. So long as the carbon remains radioactive, and as already stated, the half-life of carbon-14, the time that only half of the carbon-14 is still there and not turned into carbon-13, well, that's 6,000 years. Okay, but who wants a radioactive battery? Is that not dangerous? Yes, but the authors of the paper explain that they propose to enclose each radioactive diamond inside a non-radioactive diamond, a diamond inside of a diamond, if you will, the outer diamond providing a radiation shield to the user, thus providing the best of both worlds. To put this into a scale we can all relate to, the diamond within a diamond battery would have less radioactivity than a banana. Okay, reality check time. Although they last forever, relative to a AA battery you buy at your local electronics store, the power output is relatively, well, absolutely, they have a small power plant. We are talking about each proposed diamond generating about 3 microwatts of power, compared to your AA battery's 1.5 volts of power. So you would need 500 diamond batteries to provide the same level of power as one AA battery. That said, what they lack in raw voltage, it more than compensates for in longevity. A diamond nuclear battery can expect to last, well, a standard 3-volt battery lasts a year. This battery would last 6,000 years, and at which point it would still be giving off 1.5 volts, which would peter off to 1 volt in about 10,000 years. So let us break down some of the numbers. The UK, where this research was done, generates about 95,000 tons of graphite waste. Okay, so let's say that 10% of a 100 kilo block of graphite can be turned into diamond. I couldn't find any reliable numbers, but let us guess. Guessing's fun. Each battery uses about 20 grams of carbon-14. So we would get 500 batteries per 100 kilos. That means the current waste of the UK alone could create almost 500,000 batteries, and each diamond generates about 3 microwatts, so we create a virtual power plant generating almost 1.5 kilowatts of power. For some nuclear battery contrast, the plutonium-based battery found in Cassini, Voyager, Galileo, and New Horizons space probe, and of course the Curiosity Mars rover, it generates about 10 watts per gram, compared to the diamond, which can only muster 0.15 watts per kilogram. But plutonium's half-life is a mere 88 years. That means after a millennium, the plutonium battery would be lucky to be generating 0.1 watt, while the diamond battery would still be going strong at full power. And of course, this points to real value of diamond batteries, their longevity. With a half-life measured in millennium, they are more than perfect for implants like pacemakers or whatever future medicine may require. And what about satellites and stellar? Well, even interstellar probes. A power supply measured in thousands of years provides so many possibilities. So it seems, on the good side, we have the potential replacement to the plutonium batteries, which we've relied upon for trans-Jupiter exploration. Why trans-Jupiter? Well, beyond Jupiter's orbit, well, the sun is a wimp, power-wise. That is why batteries or some other source of power is needed to make exploration in these regions possible. So not only does this paper promise an exciting new, extremely long-term power supply, but also points to a way of transforming nuclear waste into a safe and useful product. And again, diamond nuclear batteries, the coolest thing ever. Okay, another scientific milestone of 2016 was the three-person baby. What do I mean by that? Well, let me explain. Remember that weird class in high school biology? Or that awkward talk with mom and dad? Or just a Google search? That's a thing now, isn't it? Okay, let's go with it. Once we were old enough to notice that there was a difference between boys and girls, and that babies were not delivered by storks, well, that's the time we usually get the talk. We're told that when a mommy and a daddy love each other very, very much, or, as we may hear on TV, when two people have had a little too much wine, they kind of wrestle. Or so we're told. But of course, the internet makes it quite clear that we're not talking about WWE. Later, in biology class, we're told, nay, lied to, I say, that a baby's genetic makeup is 50% from the mother and 50% from the father. Well, this is not the entire story. The genetic part that builds your body, determines eye color, dictates size, skin color, in the ear of Trump, the size of a person's hand, the stuff we can see and know, that's part of our nuclear DNA. And no, I don't mean nuclear as in the power plant, but nuclear as in found in the nucleus of our cells. That's the part that's equally donated 50-50 from the sperm and the egg. But the other crucial hidden genetic player, and that genetic bundle provided by the mother alone, is called the cellular or mitochondrial DNA. Some of you may be asking, what are mitochondria? They are the powerhouse of almost all eukaryote life on Earth. Think anything bigger than a bacteria. And by almost, I mean it was only in this last year that a eukaryote known to currently exist without mitochondria. Like trying to know when Vladimir co-opted Trump, the exact moment or mechanism may be lost to the minutiae of time. But at some point in the evolution of life, there were two separate cells, one being mitochondria, a quote, bacterium that has an effective way of turning sugar and oxygen into ATP, or adenosine triphosphate. the energy currency of cellular life, and it did so in abundance. And a lot of other, quote, bacteria that tried to make a living off whatever energy-rich compounds it could find in the oceans, usually breaking down sugars and the like, but in a far less efficient way. Anyway, at some point, and no one knows exactly the how and the why, but a mitochondrial cell, or more accurately, an aerobic prokaryote, was swallowed, but not eaten, into the cell of a standard, if that's an appropriate term, cell or bacterium. The host cell found that the mitochondria might steal a little bit of the sugar it had, but it pumped out a lot of ATP. And after all, that is why the host had the sugar in the first place. So the host did whatever it could to keep the mitochondria happy and well supplied with sugar. Now, from the mitochondria's point of view, it found itself inside its new host, a reliable source of sugar. But as well, it had a layer of protection from hostile organisms, chemicals, and the like. So they did what they did well. They turned sugar into ATP. And as host and mitochondria evolved, each became better tuned to the needs and wants of the other. And bam, you have an endosymbiotic relationship in almost every cell of life. Side note, in plants, you have mitochondria, but it seems some pre-plant cell repeated the mitochondria trick, only this time with with a cell called a chloroplast. In the case of a chloroplast, a more likely candidate is conjectured, and that being cyanobacteria or blue-green algae. This gives plants the superpower to generate their own sugars, which in turn can be used by the mitochondria to fuel the plant cell. Returning to our three-parent baby, this inclusion, invasion, abduction of mitochondria had little effect on the evolution or genetics. Asexual reproduction was a slow, albeit constant, driver of evolution. It was not until the invention of sex, that is, the mixing of nuclear genetic information from two parent organisms, well, that evolution really took off. Once the naughtiness started to happen, well, like the bitten apple from the mythical Garden of Eden, everything changed, and fast, relatively. With the inclusion of sexual reproduction, what you now had, as part of the main cell, nuclear DNA swaps, i.e. the egg and the sperm provided half the DNA that made a new organism. Its ability to shape and transform the organism was immense. However, still with every cell, there was a hidden packet of DNA, that symbiotic guest who never experienced sex, at least genetically, and has been in the background ever since. Well, forever. As you may or may not know, a new life, a baby, accepts the nuclear DNA from the father. It also receives nuclear DNA from the mother, but also is gifted the mitochondria and their special package of DNA exclusively from the mother. So to recap what I just said, there are actually three sources of DNA. The genetic makeup from our nuclear DNA, which is provided in equal parts from mom and dad, but you also have a cellular DNA, i.e. the DNA in the cells, or more accurately, what scientists now call an organelle, the mitochondria, which is provided exclusively by mom. This is why you may hear, when trying to track down historical figures, the use of the term mitochondrial DNA. This is a much more stable and consistent DNA. Why stable? Remember, this DNA is not subject to the bifurcated randomness of sexual reproduction. Its DNA is more or less constant, with the exception, of course, of random errors and internal mutations, then cosmic rays. So mitochondrial DNA changes at a much slower rate, and thus is a good constant genetic clock. And because every human on the planet, everyone, has a single mother, a mitochondrial Eve, if you will. That is, at the moment of speciation, the very first human, that person's mitochondrial DNA is the same, sans genetic mutation, as the mitochondrial DNA in you and me today. And to push back the clock even further, that DNA in a mitochondria is the same DNA that was first incorporated into the first eukaryote. As in, everyone not only can trace back their mitochondrial DNA to Eve, used not in the biblical sense, the first human, in actuality can be traced back to Blob, the very first eukaryote. Okay, now that you know the background, what is the quote best science story of 2016? A child was born from three parents. How is this possible? You are likely to know now, if you were listening to my genetic refresher course, but let me spell it out plainly. Two of the parents provided their genetic contribution via petri dish. That is, the DNA of an egg and a sperm were combined to form the nucleus of the egg cell. This is common practice in in vitro fertilization, or what was once referred to as test tube babies. This part of the genetics is the 50-50 combination of mom and dad's DNA that makes up the baby's nuclear DNA. What was different about this conception was the egg, as in the cell itself, sans its nuclear DNA, was from a third donor. They took the DNA from the egg and combined with the DNA of the sperm. So they take the combined nuclear DNA that they created in the petri dish, and they injected that into a third person's, the egg cell, and created a baby. So this child, now born, has DNA from three parents. But one must ask, why would you want to do such a thing? Well, as it turns out, mitochondrial DNA is not perfect. You can get several genetic disorders of the mitochondria. And because they are shared with every cell in your body, their potential to cause havoc and even death is quite acute. The aim of this experiment, if that's an appropriate term, was to create a baby that was, quote, normal combination of genetic material from mom and dad, but without the genetic mitochondrial sabotage that can occur from mitochondrial genetic disease, i.e. the mother's cells, including the eggs, have a genetic defect that may affect the health of said theoretical child. So what the scientists did was take an egg cell from a healthy donor, remove the nuclear DNA, then they combined the genome of mom and dad, and created a new baby, but this time containing healthy mitochondria. Okay, now some of you may be nerd enough to know that this was not the first triparent baby to be produced. However, in previous attempts, there was an outwash. Not sure what the right term is here, but enough of the mother's mitochondria managed to hitch a ride with the egg's DNA, as in during the physical process of removing the nuclear DNA, some bits of the cell that were included were also mitochondria. Well, this extra bit is enough to contaminate the host egg cell, and thus make the possibility of mitochondrial DNA disease possible enough to make the operation deemed a failure. This meant in time it was possible the defective mitochondria of the mother could overwhelm the quote host cell mitochondria, and thus the child would suffer the effects of such genetic defect. But this technique used last year has a transfer rate of maternal mitochondria of less than 1%, making it extremely unlikely that there would be, quote, a revenge of the clones effect of the mother's DNA overwhelming the host's mitochondria. So here's to a happy and healthy baby thanks to genetic modification. We'll be right back after this break.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Electronics Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 CITR FM, your trans-Neptunian radio broadcast for science, skepticism, and rational thinking. And we're back. Next up, we're going to do a bit of an experiment. I found some interesting articles online, and I'm going to share them with you. So far, we've been giving you my top science stories of 2016. But of course, there's more than just me in the universe. So this is from Science News, Year in Review. AlphaGo scores a win for artificial intelligence. In a hotel room in Seoul, Korea, early in 2016, a centuries-old strategy game offered a glimpse into a fantastic future of computing. The computer program AlphaGo bested a world's champion player at the Chinese board game Go, 4-1. The victory shocked Go players and computer gurus alike. The match was a powerful demonstration of the potential of computers that can learn from experience. Elements of artificial intelligence are already a reality, from medical diagnosis to self-driving cars. And computer programs can even find the fastest routes through the London Underground. AlphaGo's design mimics the way the human brain tackles problems and allows the program to fine-tune itself based on new experiences. The system was trained using 30 million positions from 160,000 games of Go played by human experts. AlphaGo's creators at Google DeepMind honed the software even further by having to play games slightly altered versions of itself as a sort of survival of the fittest. These learning experiences allowed AlphaGo to more efficiently sweat over its next move. Programs aimed at simpler games play out every single hypothetical game that could result from each available choice in a branching pattern, a brute force approach to computing. But this technique becomes impractical for more complex games such as chess. So many chess-playing programs sample only a small subset of possible outcomes. That was true of Deep Blue, the computer that beat chess master Garry Kasparov in 1997. But Go offers players even more choices than chess does. A full-size Go board includes 361 playing spaces, compared to chess's 64, and often has various battles taking place across the board simultaneously and can last for many more moves. AlphaGo overcomes Go's sheer complexity by drawing on its own developing knowledge to choose which moves to evaluate. This intelligent selection led to the program's surprising triumph. Real-world problems have complexities far exceeding those of chess or Go, but the winning strategy demonstrated in 2016 could be a game-changer. Our next science story from Science News Year in Review, a planet lurks around the star next door. Worlds in the Alpha Centauri system, the trio of stars closest to our sun, have been a staple of science fiction for decades. From Star Trek to Avatar, writers have dreamed up exotic landscapes and inhabitants for interstellar explorers to encounter. Now a planet around one of those stars is no longer fiction. In August, breathless headlines heralded the discovery of a small, potentially habitable planet orbiting Proxima Centauri, a dim red dwarf star just 4.24 light-years away. The planet, Proxima b, isn't the first roughly Earth-sized massed planet discovered. It's not the first seen in a star's habitable zone, the region where the temperatures are just right for liquid water. Nor is it the first found around a red dwarf, the most common type of star in the galaxy. Proxima b got special attention for one reason. It's the closest known exoplanet to us. According to Roy Barnes, an astronomer at the University of Washington, Seattle, this is a game changer for extraplanetary science. The fact that it's so close means we have an opportunity to follow up on it better than any other planet discovered so far. When it comes to interstellar distance, so close is still incomprehensibly far. Proxima Centauri is roughly 400 trillion kilometers away. The fastest spacecraft to leave Earth, the New Horizons probe that zipped past Pluto in 2015, would need nearly 80,000 years to get there, traveling at its launch speed of roughly 58,000 kilometers per hour. But if Earthlings ever do venture beyond the solar system, Proxima Centauri is likely to be the first stop. Astronomers found Proxima b by looking for a tiny wobble in the speed of its parent star, the sign of a gravitational tug from an orbiting planet. Observations from telescopes in Chile confirmed its existence. But not much is known about the planet. Researchers have determined, based on its tiny wobble, that the planet is at least 1.3 times the mass of Earth, and it travels along an 11.2-day orbit. Its habitability is speculative. The planet basks in enough light to sustain liquid water. But other factors might foil the possibilities of life. The planet's climate depends strongly on the characteristics of its atmosphere, if it even has one. No one knows if Proxima b has a solid surface where water could pool and critters that could crawl around. No one knows the planet's size. Even its mass is just a minimum estimate. With a near-term voyage to Proxima b unlikely, the best chance to learn more about the planet might come from a transit, when a planet periodically slips between us and its sun. If the planet transit, it would block a smidgen of the starlight from reaching Earth, subtly dimming Proxima Centauri. Astronomers could then estimate the size of Proxima b by measuring how much light the planet intercepts. A transit could also pin down the true mass by removing some of the ambiguity in the details of the planet's orbit. By considering the size of the planet and its mass, researchers could then calculate the planet's density, revealing whether Proxima b is really a rocky world like Earth, as a lot of initial new coverage jumped to the conclusion, or a gassy one. During a transit, a sliver of light would also have passed through Proxima b's atmosphere. molecules in the atmosphere would block specific wavelengths of starlight, allowing astronomers to deduce the chemical makeup of the atmosphere and hunt for any byproducts of living organisms. The odds of a transit are slim. There's just a 1.5% chance the orbit's orientation is right, and one early investigation is not promising. The Canadian Microvariable and Oscillations of Star Satellite, MOST for short, monitored Proxima Centauri for hints of a transiting planet in May 2014 and May 2015 for about 44 days and turned up nothing. But researchers aren't giving up yet. Several groups are keeping an eye on Proxima Centauri in the hopes of catching the telltale dip from a transit. Even if astronomers can't learn anything more about Proxima B, there will be plenty of other nearby worlds to study. Late in 2017, NASA plans to launch the Transit Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, a telescope on a two-year mission to monitor about 200,000 stars from transiting exoplanets, many of these stars among the Sun's closest neighbors. Astronomers estimate that TESS will turn up about 1,700 worlds in addition to the more than 3,500 already discovered. That haul could include more than 500 planets less than twice the size of Earth, roughly 50 of which might lie within the habitable zone of their star. And because TESS will only add transiting planets, many will be ripe for follow-up investigations by further observations, such as by the James Webb Space Telescope, which will view the cosmos in the infrared and is scheduled for launch in 2018. More planets mean more chances of finding life beyond our solar system, but finding aliens isn't the only goal. Astronomers want to understand how our solar system and how the Earth fits into the universe, what's special and what's not special about our solar system. And interstellar travel will continue to capture imaginations. In the 1935 short story Proxima Centauri, published just 18 years after astronomers measured the distance to the star, Murray Leinster wrote of Earth's first interstellar spaceship closing in on an imaginary planet orbiting our stellar neighbor. In Lister's story, an alien race of mobile carnivore plants ended up devouring most of the crew. Hopefully our first ambassadors to an exoplanet, whether Proxima B or elsewhere, will fare better. Our next story from Science News, Year in Review. Minimal genome makes its debut. Synthetic cell may reveal what is necessary for life. One of biology's biggest achievements in 2016 was intentionally as small as possible, building a bacterium with only 473 genes. That pint-sized genetic blueprint, the smallest of any known free-living cell, is a milestone in a decades-long effort to create an organism containing just the bare essential necessities to exist and reproduce. Such minimal genome cells might eventually serve as templates for lab-made organisms that pump out medicines, make innovative chemicals for industry and agriculture, or churn out other molecules not yet imagined. The project also identified genes crucial for the microbe's survival, yet largely unfamiliar to science, highlighting major gaps in researchers' grasp of life's playbook. The newly engineered bacterium was praised as a technical triumph. In 2010, researchers at the J. Gregg Venter Institute in La Jolla, California, had stitched together a copy of an entire genome of the bacteria Mycoplasma mycodes and popped it into a cell of another bacterium whose genome had been removed. But that synthetic cell, dubbed JCVI Synth 1.0, contained a full copy of an existing genome, with more than 1 million chemical building blocks of DNA, including 901 genes. It was far from minimal. The latest version, JCVI Synth 3.0, reported in March in Science, has roughly half that much DNA. It's also the first cell built using human design principles. One segment of the genome has genes of various processes, such as DNA repair, grouped together rather than scattered willy-nilly. Abandoning the untidiness of evolution for a logic-driven blueprint enables a plug-and-play approach. To tinker with a metabolic process such as glycolysis, for example, rather than changing one gene, then another, you could pop out a whole molecule and then pop in a new one. Making such fundamental changes to the genome while still getting a functioning cell is noteworthy. They could have found out that, no matter what they did putting it together, it broke. The potential of synthetic cells is enormous. Scientists have succeeded in engineering an existing organism, such as yeast, to help make, for example, malaria drugs. Now, little cellular factories designed to be highly efficient and tailored to specific tasks could be within sight. The technique used to build JCVI Synth 3.0, especially when considered alongside other engineering tools such as the recently developed CRISPR-Cas9 system, are a meaningful step towards the once-distant goal of self-replicating mini-machines. Since announcing JCVI Synth 3.0, the team has used the same engineering technique to turn the fast-growing bacterium Vibronatogenes into a laboratory workhouse. The engineered Vibro, dubbed VMAX, cuts the time it takes to do particular lab experiments in half compared to the original. The minimal genome effort also aims at a larger philosophical question. What is life? In a lecture in 1984, Origin of Life expert Howard Morowitz discussed how studying the small and simple mycoplasm genome might invigorate basic biology, much in the way that the study of the hydrogen atom sharpened questions for physicists and chemists. Many scientists, for example, were stunned to learn that JCVI Synth 3.0 had 65 genes with no known functions that were nevertheless required for survival. This is one of the best studied organisms, and we haven't even the foggiest idea what those genes are doing. Isn't science exciting? And we're going to close out today with Mental Floss's record-breaking discoveries of 2016 in science and in space science. So let's listen and learn.
It's that time of year again when everyone looks back at all the good and the bad stuff that happened since the last time Earth was in this spot relative to the sun. It's been a pretty cool year for science around the globe, and we here at SciShow like to highlight the superlatives, some of the biggest, oldest, fastest, and most amazing discoveries of 2016. In early January, the highest prime number ever found was announced. You might remember this from elementary school math, but a prime number is only divisible by itself and one. I'm not going to say the actual number because it would take months, it's more than 22 million digits long, but to keep it brief, it's equivalent to 2 to the power of 74,207,281 minus 1. That specific format, 2 to the power of n minus 1, is what's called a Mersenne prime. The number was found by the Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search, or GIMPS for short, in which a bunch of networked computers try to come up with prime numbers while they're not being used for something else. It's a citizen science project like the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence at Home, where you run a program on your personal device as part of a huge computing effort. GIMPS turned up this number by testing a bunch of Mersenne numbers for primeness, because they're not all prime. For example, 2 to the power of 4 minus 1 is 15, which is also divisible by 3 and 5. Why do we care about searching for prime numbers? It's not just for the joy of math. They can be super important. We can use them to keep our credit cards safe. When you buy something online, your credit card number gets encrypted to protect your information. Usually this happens through RSA encryption, which encrypts data using the number you get from multiplying two really big prime numbers. Then the seller's computer needs to know those prime numbers to decrypt the data. Because it's really hard to factor out the two primes by brute force, it's hard for people to steal your credit card information. The prime numbers that protect your credit card are typically around 300 digits, so the GIMPS number is actually way too big to be useful for RSA encryption, but it is a neat mathematical achievement, and it shows what idle computers can do when you give them some busy work. Also in January, archaeologists turned up the oldest physical evidence of tea. While the oldest written evidence for tea consumption goes back to the year 59 BCE, we still don't know where it came from or when people started drinking it. Tea leaves are pretty fragile and usually don't last well across the centuries, so this surprising discovery pushed back the date for the earliest tea drinkers to about 141 BCE. In the 1990s, a strange lump of plant matter was discovered in the tomb of the Chinese Emperor Qingdi of the Han Dynasty. Some of the remains were identified right away, like rice and millet. Other leaves were shaped like tea buds, but that alone wasn't enough to be sure. Like many plants, tea leaves contain tiny hard crystals called phytoliths made of calcium oxalate. These can be seen with a microscope and used to identify different kinds of leaves. Using mass spectrometry, the researchers also found other chemicals like caffeine and theanine. While caffeine is in a variety of plants, you'll only find theanine in the family that includes tea. And this tea was the good stuff. The sample from the tomb seems to be high-quality budded leaves from the very tips of branches, which are used in so-called fine-plucked tea. So now we know that Chinese emperors were enjoying delicious tea even earlier than we thought, more than 2,100 years ago. Finally, Move over, birds, there's a new fastest horizontal flyer in town. And it's a mammal, the Brazilian free-tailed bat. The peregrine falcon is well known as the world's fastest animal. It can make gravity-assisted dives topping 300 kilometers per hour. Without the help of gravity, though, the records are a little more modest. The previous champions, a group of birds aptly known as swifts, have been clocked at 110 kilometers per hour. But the Brazilian free-tailed bat blows that record out of the water, reaching speeds of 160 kilometers per hour in short bursts during their long nighttime hunting expeditions. They might use these speed bursts like a cheetah does, to dash after prey and nab it. Some researchers found this out by sticking tiny radio transmitters to seven bats with a non-permanent glue and following them in an airplane to collect data. Birds are really good at flying, obviously, and they have wings that are well adapted for speed, so it's a bit surprising that a mammal could wrestle this crown from them. At the very least, the scientists say that this gives us a reason to reevaluate the flight abilities and adaptations of bats in general to see what else we're missing. 2016 is almost over, and I don't think any of us are going to miss it. But for the last year, astronomers have been working hard to catch up on what happened in the universe during the almost 13.8 billion years we weren't around for. And they've made some record-breaking discoveries along the way, including some of the farthest, faintest, and youngest objects in the universe. Back in March, astronomers working with the Hubble Space Telescope reported that they'd spotted the farthest galaxy we've ever seen in a study published in the Astrophysical Journal. The galaxy is called GN-Z11, and it's at least 13.3 billion years old. So old that in the billions of years the light from that galaxy has taken to get to Earth, the universe has expanded to the point where the galaxy is actually 32 billion light years away. To measure its distance, the researchers calculated how the wavelength of the light from the galaxy has shifted. Since that galaxy is moving away from us, the wavelength of its light is shifted toward the longer, redder side of the spectrum in what's known as redshift. Figuring out how much of its light has been redshifted helps determine a galaxy's distance. The previous record holder had a redshift of 8.68, but this galaxy has a redshift of 11.1. For comparison, the first stars ever born, some of the most distant objects in the universe, would have a redshift of around 20. But when Hubble's more powerful successor, the James Webb Space Telescope, launches in the fall of 2018, scientists should be able to detect galaxies with even higher redshifts that are even farther away. So hopefully GN-Z11 won't be the record holder for long. But astronomers found more than just the farthest galaxy we've ever seen this year, they also found the faintest satellite galaxy we've ever seen. So far, astronomers have discovered around 50 satellite galaxies that orbit the Milky Way. And in November, in another study published in the Astrophysical Journal, researchers announced that they'd found the dimmest one yet. It's called Virgo 1, and it has an absolute magnitude of negative 0.8. Absolute magnitude is a measure of an object's brightness from around 33 light years away, and the higher the number, the dimmer the object. For comparison, the Andromeda Galaxy, the closest major galaxy to the Milky Way, has an absolute magnitude of negative 20.9, meaning that from 33 light years away, it would be almost as bright as the Sun is from Earth, whereas Virgo 1 would be about as bright as some of the brightest stars in the night sky. Virgo 1 was discovered using the Subaru telescope in Hawaii, which could spot the galaxy because it has a larger lens and a larger field of view than other telescopes that have been used to look for satellite galaxies before. And its discovery is helping solve a problem. Current theories about how the universe formed predict that there should be a lot more satellite galaxies than we've seen. But Virgo 1's discovery might mean that there are hundreds more faint satellite galaxies out there, so astronomers might soon be finding more galactic neighbors. In addition to some of the oldest things we've ever found, we've also found the youngest exoplanet we have ever seen. Welcome to the planetary family, K2-33b. The discovery is super useful for astronomers trying to learn more about the life cycles of planets. Most exoplanets we've seen so far are at least a billion years old, which is middle-aged by planetary standards. But this new planet is just a baby. It's only 5 to 10 million years old. The research took some of the best instruments we have, and the results were published in the journal Nature in June. First, NASA's Kepler Space Telescope recorded periodic dimming in the star K2-33, which is around 473 light years from Earth in the constellation Scorpius. Then, the W.M. Keck Observatory in Hawaii confirmed the dimming was being caused by a planet. Then, NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope took more readings about the planet's neighborhood, while data from Kepler was used to confirm its orbit size and mass. So it was a team effort. To find the age of the planet, researchers first used its parent star's density and temperature to figure out the star's age. They found that the star is between 5 and 10 million years old, and since stars come before planets, the planet has to be in that range too. The baby exoplanet is about 6 times larger than Earth, and it orbits its star about every 5 days. And researchers hope studying this new planet and others like it will teach us more about how planets form.
And that's all for today. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and, of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.